May it please the court. As an attorney, there is perhaps no less defensible reason for failing to promote the success of a client than doing so for personal financial gain. In the case before you today, virtually every one of respondents' actions was motivated by his desire to attain more money for himself, money above and beyond that to which he was reasonably entitled. Respondent's behavior is made all the more confusing by the fact that he has consistently maintained that he acted ethically and fairly, even as he was attempting to strip his client of the right to decide for herself whether or not she wanted to settle her case, even as he was asking the court to force a settlement agreement on his client that she didn't want. Respondent's actions were not ethical, and they were not fair, and his representation of Ms. Davis, as well as his client trust account practices, certainly call into question his fitness to practice law. As to respondent's representation of Vera Davis, there are very few facts that are actually in dispute as between the parties. What is in dispute is the extent to which Mr. Coleman's actions resulted in violations of the rules of professional conduct. Mr. Coleman does not dispute that after having received between $30,000 and $50,000 in fixed hourly fees, he converted their fee agreement to a contingent agreement for a one-third contingency fee. He does not dispute that he inserted into that contingency contract a provision that purported to give him the exclusive right to settle his client's case with or without her consent. And he does not dispute that Ms. Davis...
Did she sign that agreement?
She did sign the agreement, though she did testify that she did not read the portion of the agreement that purported to give him the exclusive right to settle her case. And respondent does not dispute in this case that when Ms. Davis rejected the $20,000 settlement offer in question, he verbally accepted that agreement on her behalf. The informant pled.
And your argument is based on the fiduciary obligation of an attorney, so it's not an arm's length contract. That, because normally you're bound by what you sign, but you're saying he had an additional obligation because of his confidential relationship to act in her interests.
He did have a separate obligation under the rules, under 4-1.2, to follow the directive of his client. And Mr. Coleman has argued that that provision in the contract provided consent, so to speak, on her part. But that provision of the contract is void against public policy, and it's certainly in direct conflict with Rule 4-1.2.
So under no circumstances could any provision like that be agreed to in a contract or written in a contract?
No, and the reason for that is that fiduciary duty, that special relationship between the attorney and client. There's a potential for real abuse there when the client has no authority, when they have prospectively signed away their right to settle their case. It would be akin to an attorney contractually forbidding a client from terminating representation. It's just an infringement on that client's rights.
And that's the only area that the DHP found a violation in?
It is the only area where the majority of the DHP found the violation, though we certainly feel that the recommendation, even with respect to that violation, isn't appropriate in this case. The DHP recommended that Mr. Coleman, as a result of the violation of 4-1.2, receive a public reprimand. Mr. Coleman received a public reprimand by this court in April of 2008 for diligence violations when he failed to file a discrimination petition for his client as agreed upon. And the disciplinary hearing panel's recommendation that he receive another public reprimand on top of the one already received in 2008 just doesn't fit within a progressive system of discipline.
Now, what about the trust account issues? Is the OCDC's position is a violation of the trust account? Is it absolute penalty and should be treated as such? They should know what they're doing. They can't plead confusion or somehow I didn't know I was commingling funds or not.
Certainly, and the ABA guidelines take that into account. The sanctioning guideline for violations of Rule 4-1.15, which it prohibits commingling, says that that suspension is appropriate when an attorney should have known that they were acting inappropriately with respect to a client trust account. So pleading
the ignorance. The DHP basically found, though, that there was no intent to take client funds or to have insufficient funds or have client funds supplement his. He kept them both in there but was not aware that the way he was handling it was in violation of the rule. Do you disagree with that or with that interpretation of what they found?
I understand that the DHP found, I think, that there wasn't even a commingling of funds, let alone an intent to...
Both were in there, but he was trying to keep them separate in there, sort of in the same account,
yes.
If I understood.
And again, the sanctioning guideline takes into account that an attorney is charged with knowing and also with should have known that he was acting inappropriately. And there's no way when Mr. Coleman was keeping his personal funds in the account, depositing client funds in on top of his personal funds, writing personal checks from that account, that he could not have known, or at least that he should have known, that he was acting inappropriately with respect to his client.
Usually when we have trust fund cases, there's times when there's insufficient funds in the account to cover both the personal bills and so forth and the client's, the money that the client's entitled to. Here we don't have that issue.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. No, there is no allegation that Mr. Coleman converted his client funds, simply that he commingled his personal funds with the client funds, and that's demonstrated by the bank account records and Mr. Coleman's own testimony. He testified that he was keeping $1,100 in his bank account that were personal funds, in his client trust account that were personal funds. 6 days later, he deposited $10,000 in client settlement funds on top of his personal funds.
Do we know why he did that, why he didn't just put them in separate accounts?
Mr. Coleman has testified that this is a common practice, that because he writes client checks for disbursement of settlement funds, that the personal funds that are kept in that account on a regular basis are never commingled with the client funds. But Mr. Coleman fails to take into account that just writing the check doesn't mean that the money is withdrawn. A client can keep that check and fail to cash that check for any length of time. He further fails to take into account that when you're talking about retainers or other forms of money that's getting deposited into that account, that money is commingled for an exponentially longer period of time. For example, the time that it would take him to earn those fees, to make them his, to make them personal funds and not client funds. Mr. Coleman's behavior with respect to his trust account, as well as his representation of Vera Davis, does call into question his fitness to practice law. The fees that he charged Ms. Davis
Is he acknowledged the mistakes? Said he'll do his trust account differently, or does he acknowledge any of these issues as being mistaken practice?
Not at all. Quite the opposite. Mr. Coleman has maintained at the DHP level, as well as in his briefs to this court, that his behavior was within the confines of the rules, that it was fair, that it was ethical, that it was fair to his client. And that's part of why the OCDC feels that the sanctioning recommendation by the DHP was inappropriate in this case. They did not perform, at least in their decision, an analysis with respect to aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And the aggravating circumstances in this case were substantial. First and foremost, Mr. Coleman's complete refusal to acknowledge that his conduct was wrong. The multiple offenses, the past conduct, his experience
in the
law.
And what's the ABA say about progressive discipline?
The ABA sanctioning guidelines provide for progressive discipline, and our office has always interpreted our disciplinary system to be one that provides for progressive discipline. And Mr. Coleman has had two previous admonitions. He then had the public reprimand that was issued by this court in April.
Because they were about 10 years apart, the two before.
The admonitions, they are. And again, in looking at the mitigating and aggravating circumstances, the remoteness of his previous offenses can be considered a mitigating circumstance. But that's certainly the only one that appears to be present in this case. And The public reprimand that he received was in April of 2008, so it was certainly closer to in time to the offenses that we're talking about here. I would just touch upon the fact that Mr. Coleman's conduct in converting his fee agreement resulted in an unreasonable fee to Ms. Davis. The contingency fee is meant to encompass the entirety of an attorney's fee.
It is possible that he charged by the hour, and then he said it's getting too expensive. You want me to continue? I mean, given the limited representation rules we passed, you used up all your money now. If you want me to continue, I have to do it on a contingent fee. To be sure, his record showing I did spend enough time to use up $30,000, and now for me to continue, I need a contingent fee. What would be wrong with that?
Well, as set forth in informant's brief, courts take a differing view on whether that conversion in and of itself is appropriate. There are a number of courts that say that kind of conversion is attended by a presumption of invalidity because of the special relationship that exists between an attorney and a client and the potential for abuse in that relationship. There wouldn't be anything
I think we passed a rule about unbundled services.
Yes.
Where we say one part, you paid your fee there, and that's done. We can charge you another part as part of the unbundling. That's your new fee, and we could have five different unbundled services.
But you could end up with 100% of the recovery being yours in this if you don't consider the dollar amounts paid as part of the contingent fee. I mean,
yes.
Usually hourly and contingent combinations, you wouldn't put one stack one on top of the other where you might end up with two-thirds of the recovery.
Correct, and we're not contending that the money, the $30,000 to $50,000 that Ms. Davis paid him was in and of itself unreasonable, but to charge a contingency fee without giving any credit due for the money that had already been paid results in an exponentially unreasonable...
Do you show records of time spent on the case for the $30,000?
No, Mr. Coleman was not able to provide any records of that, and he contends that it was sent to Ms. Davis with her file, but Ms. Davis testified that she had no records of that either.
And there were no records of what she paid either.
There were receipts.
But he maintained no records.
He maintained no records, that's correct.
And is that a part of the disciplinary action?
It was not charged in the information, no.
Could it have been charged?
I believe so, yes.
Did you recommend him for possibly probation or sending it to, Missouri Bar has an excellent service for office management. Linda Hollenschlager runs that at the Missouri Bar, and they help people with their management or managing their offices. Did the OCDC make any recommendations regarding that?
No, we've recommended that Mr. Coleman receive an actual suspension based on the fact that he has completely refused to acknowledge that any of his practices might have been wrong. So it makes the possibility that he would successfully complete a period of probation.
So the indefinite suspension, what would you do afterwards? After a year, he reapplies. Would you put conditions on his set?
Yes, he would have to go. Well, I can't say that for sure, but he would go through the restatement process, and at that point, our office would better be able to evaluate whether he had taken steps to improve his practice during his time of suspension, which I think is necessary. He needs that motivation to take action because
at
this point
he is
not. I'm sorry.
He wouldn't have a practice. He'd have to show you a new. New situation after 1 year suspension, you wouldn't have a practice.
Correct, he would not. But we do have attorneys that use that period of time to attend CLEs or to attend ethics schools or work with a law
would
practice
you recommend
management
ethics
consultant.
School, you do ethics school.
Certainly, there are a number of tools that would be beneficial in trying to improve Mr. Coleman's practice.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. There are two questions presented to this court for consideration. One involved Vera Davis, a federal civil rights plaintiff, who was suing the Western Missouri Mental Health Center, on whose behalf respondent unsuccessfully sought to negotiate a $20,000 settlement through an assistant attorney general of the state of Missouri. The other question involved an IOLTA check written to cover assessed Missouri Supreme Court expenses arising from a previous disciplinary case in which respondent was assessed a public reprimand. Below, the regional hearing panel acquitted respondent of the charge of commingling in his IOTA account after a hearing. Similarly, the same panel acquitted respondent of all except one subcharge involving Vera Davis. Out of the 21 charges, only one was sustained. The Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel elected to appeal to this court from a written decision of the regional hearing panel, including its recommendation of public reprimand. For his part, respondent contends that the regional hearing panel should have acquitted him on all charges and subcharges, as the informant failed to meet its burden by preponderance of the evidence on any of them.
Do you think it's all right that you have your client sign in the contract that you have a right to settle and not her, and she has to take any settlement you think is appropriate?
At the time that I did it, I obviously believed that, Your Honor. Otherwise, I would not have done it. I was of the view that my client had paid me over a number of years in three different cases, not one case. I wanted to continue. She told me she had no money. Because of the 13th Amendment, none of us work for free. So I said, okay, what I will do is forgive all the past due amounts that you owe me. And I'll take this, all three cases, on a contingent fee basis.
But with no credit for the $30,000 she'd already paid.
No, because I'd already earned that, and I had waived other fees.
In fact, she still owed you about $9,647, and you waived that?
Yes, ma'am, I certainly did.
Yeah. Do you have records of that in your files?
I gave all of my records and all of my files at my client's request to her. And the way we billed, and she paid diligently.
You didn't keep copies of your billings?
No. We gave it all to her. And in fact, the way she paid, Your Honor, was pursuant to, we would send out billings periodically in writing, showing what had been paid and what was still owed. And she would pay diligently all the time.
So and you don't have those records anyplace?
On the 4D, you have an obligation to give your client their records on the case, but as far as keeping your financial records is whether someone's paid you or not paid you. You're allowed to keep those things. Give her a copy, but you're allowed to keep records of your finances. Otherwise, how do you pay taxes? How do you deal with your business?
Well, Your Honor, we have... The records that we had consisted of the ledgers and our monthly ledger, which would go back years. And we also have, some of the computers have been thrown out, the old computers, because she came initially in 2001 and left in effect in 2007. So in that time period, I had different secretaries, different computers, the whole bit. But my point is that she had an accurate accounting of every cent that was paid and owed because she paid diligently. And I wrote her letters every month or every couple months or 6 weeks, however it came out, showing what we had paid, what she had paid, and what we had done. And so she's had those records twice, once we mailed her the letter and once when she picked up her files. She has never contested that she was overcharged. Her thing in the whole prospect of this litigation was that I have settled a case, quote unquote, without her consent.
Well, she told you not to, and then you'd put in this contract that you could settle it over objection, and then you did that, and she said, no, I still object. And you tried to enforce that against her, against your own client, with the court.
I didn't try to force that against her.
You went to the court and asked him to impose the settlement despite your client's objection to it.
I asked the court to enforce it against the Attorney General of the State of Missouri, not against my client. In other words, when I've been...
But your client, the Attorney General, had no problem with complying, but they wouldn't pay until your client signed off because, of course, it's her case to settle.
That came up after it became apparent she would not sign. Initially, in my dealings with the assistant...
What they found in the DHP is that she had always refused, and you knowingly thought you had the right, and I'm trying to figure out why you thought you had that right, to settle it over her objection.
Because I thought I had the right because she had signed a document to that effect that I'd mailed to her. And she did it in all three cases. The medical malpractice case that was at the Court of Appeals, the employment discrimination case that's at issue here.
Do you see that that puts you in a conflict position with your client, and that in effect that it's inappropriate for you to put that in a contract, or is that something you still think is appropriate for you to
Well, certainly
put in a contract?
Not now.
Okay.
Certainly not now. Absolutely not. But
because that's an aggravating factor the OCDC has said is that you haven't acknowledged that as being inappropriate, but you are.
Oh, yeah. Now I do. I mean, okay. I was unaware of that. Or I wouldn't have done it. I'd have just dropped her and said, tough luck. You can't pay. Go your way.
How about your trust account practices? Would you now change your trust account practices, not put personal funds in the trust account?
Same deal, Your Honor. Absolutely. But my thing with the trust account, as I explained below and as the transcript reflects, was that instantaneously I'd write the client a check. The problem with this particular situation was that the bank, UMB, required an 8-day hold. So I held the check from June 3rd and wrote it on June 11th. Now, the disciplinary counsel is arguing that she didn't cash it to 18 days later. I don't have any control over when she cashes it.
Do you now use two separate accounts, one for your own money and one for your clients, for your IOLTA account?
I always did have two separate accounts.
But you put you paid personal bills out of the IOLTA account, so that's not a separate account. That's the same.
Well, account. What it was, Judge, and to be clear, I've always had two separate accounts ever since IOLTA came into existence, and I remember when it came into existence. I mean, look young, but I remember that. Now, my point is this. The personal account has always been there. What they're talking about are three or four checks
or
that
checks.
Was left over that I wrote, one, my wife, one, and I forget who else.
Grocery store,
and I think a guy fixed my doctor.
Do you understand that was inappropriate to pay personal bills out of that IOLTA account?
Now I do. And see, what I was thinking was that if there are no client funds in that account, it's mine. I can do what I want with it. And there were no client funds in the account. That's what I'm saying. And so I thought, if there are no client funds in the account, it's nobody but mine, I can just treat it like a regular check. That's why I wrote a check to the Missouri Supreme Court for $1,475. Do you think I would have done that if I'd known that was a violation of law? No way. I mean, I give God the glory that I had $1,475. Being a solo practitioner, it's tough. It is exceedingly tough. So had I known that, I would never. I mean, that's the clearest evidence there. Mm-hmm. The fact that I would write an IOLTA check to the Supreme Court, I didn't perceive any problem. In fact, I was happy to have the money to pay it because I've been getting inquiries from the disciplinary counsel about when you're going to pay these fees. And, you know, it's not easy for somebody who does the kind of work.
Do you have these contracts out there still pending with other clients?
No.
About the payment of
no,
you
yeah.
have in the authorities and settlements?
No, I don't.
You seem to have a lot of confusion on what practices fit within ethical rules and what don't. Do you think, I know as a solo practitioner, you don't have the benefit of another mentor or someone else in your firm, that you could benefit from participating in the ethics school? To learn more about
which is
law
a lot of
practice.
Law practice management and what practices are and are not appropriate and so forth that OCDC puts on.
Well, I can benefit from anything that can be a benefit, period, regardless of what it is. I do not, however, believe, Judge, that I should be suspended. I mean, I've got kids in college. I've been doing this 30 years. I'm a former assistant U.S. attorney. I helped this lady get some money, but she rejected it. You know, the last time I was here was a civil rights case with an African-American female in federal court. Now I'm back here again. Maybe I'll just drop that whole line of work, you know, because it's just ridiculous. It is utterly ridiculous that most of these cases get thrown out of court, summary judgment, and here I've got this woman some money, and she says, take a hike. And, of course, I never got another cent. So how am I profiting? What I got was what she paid me, which is I put in the brief, on this case was approximately $6,700. The balance of the fees and expenses were in the other cases. I had a Terry Schiavo type case that was at the Missouri Court of Appeals. That case required expert witnesses, depositions, going across the country. I did all of that. in connection with that case. There's not a peep about that. That's where the bulk of the money was spent. The other case involving psychiatric, Two Rivers Psychiatric Health Center, another mental health case.
The $20,000, you hadn't offered for that before the contention fee, or was it only?
Yes, Your Honor, it was there before.
So she would have gotten the full $20,000 since you were being paid hourly? Or would you have been entitled to a third of that?
No, Your Honor, the way the agreement that she signed October 1st, I believe it was, provided that she would get two-thirds of the contingent fee, the $20,000, and I would get one-third. So in effect, I would get $6,600, $6,666,
right,
and she would get the rest. That's how it would have worked. And the previous funds that she paid me were mine to keep, and I was waiving the $9,000, whatever it was, in back fees she owed me. And that's on one case. She owed fees on the other two also. All of those were waived.
How do you know how much she owed?
Because every month I would send out letters to her stating what she had paid and what was due.
But you have no records whatsoever to show how you computed that or what she paid or what went into those figures?
Your Honor, of course, OCDC has the burden of proof. And we gave her all of the records.
You have your ledger, right, that shows
right.
your income, but
That's
not what
correct.
You did. But not what you, no, nothing at all showing what you did for that income.
It wouldn't show what we did for it, and it wouldn't show which case it went to.
Mr. Cole.
Yes, Your Honor.
The fact of the matter is that really all the way up until the end, you had a good working relationship with this lady.
It's true.
You sent out the bills, and she paid.
It's true.
She ran out of money. Things got tough.
True.
And that's when the problems arose.
That's what happened, Judge. That's it. And I wanted to keep her, so I converted it. Here I am. It's not fair. So the people that gave the hearing understood that I had a good relationship with this client until she ran out of money. And I can't work for nothing. Nobody can. So I said, let me do a contingent fee. We approached it in one case. I filed a motion with the court to enforce it against the state based on my relationship with the Assistant Attorney General. The court said there is no settlement. Judge Guyton said there is no settlement.
Because you have to have the client's agreement to settle their case. Absent what I understand you thought your contract provided otherwise, but have you ever heard of a case that got settled over a client's objection where they was not where they had not authorized the attorney to accept a settlement?
Yes, Your Honor, we had I briefed that issue and cited some cases to the court. In fact,
There's some if a client says yes, settle, and they change their mind, you will enforce it over the client's objection. But where the client had always said, no, I don't want that.
Usually you don't enforce it.
Right.
The other side enforces right. it.
That's true, Judge. That's you know, sure. plaintiffs. And I said, why can't a plaintiff enforce a settlement if a defendant can? It's just like, why can't a plaintiff get a summary judgment if a defendant can?
A plaintiff can enforce a settlement against the defendant, but not against the plaintiff. I mean, you're trying to enforce a settlement against your own client.
No,
what were the objection of your own client?
I didn't. Right. It would have been. I wasn't trying to enforce it against my client. The motion was. In fact, it says, "Coming down, Vera Steen Davis, your undersigned counsel, and respectfully moves the court to enforce the settlement agreement in the above entitled matter." So on her behalf,
the Attorney General didn't want us to enforce the settlement because they didn't have the agreement of your client. They weren't going to make the settlement true because they didn't have the agreement of your client. That's why they weren't agreeing to it.
Right.
Well, they refused to do it after the higher-up. They went to his higher-up. Right. And the higher-up says, no, you can't do that because we were agreed that with a written expressed contract to that effect, which I shared with the Assistant Attorney General, that I had the authority to settle. And
You understand now that that's an inappropriate clause
absolutely.
To put in the contract?
Do I ever?
Where'd you get the clause? I'm just curious. Where'd you get that clause from?
Your Honor, it just occurred to me naturally.
Okay.
That, you know, I didn't get it from anywhere. I just said, well, how can I continue to help her? And on all the cases where she stopped paying, and I like the cases, and I like her. And so, look, why don't we just flip it? And then, of course, Missouri statutes give me a right to convert a case at any time. So I just thought I could.
I was unaware
of any rules saying you couldn't.
Were you ever able to recover anything for her in the other two cases?
No, Your Honor. No, we were granted leave to withdraw by both courts. Okay. In fact, all three courts granted us leave to withdraw.
Yes.
And that's why we filed a motion, is to put it before the court, thinking that if we did something, you know, I let the courts review everything. Because I didn't perceive of myself as doing anything wrong until all this arose.
Okay.
And
thank you, counsel. There's none.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anything in our rules that actually sets out how this kind of conversion can occur and that says putting the contingent on top of the hourly rate is inappropriate without giving credit?
Not that I'm aware of. What the rules require is that fees be reasonable, and above that they require that a contingency fee be reasonable. And when the contingency fee is meant to encompass the entirety of the fee,
a question about that is, though, there were these other cases going on. Did you parse these out when you made your decisions, or did you look at the big picture? Obviously, between the attorney and her, they were looking at the big picture. Did you look at it that way, that it was one overall agreement that applied to all of her situations, or are you making your argument based on ciphering off the one case without considering the other obligations or work that had been done?
There was no way to cipher off the money that was allocated to each case because Mr. Coleman had no records of what was paid for what case, any billing records at all.
Well, didn't the client stipulate that he sent bills and she paid them? She herself never questioned the reasonableness of the bills, did she?
No, but that does not mean that his actions comported with the rules.
No, but it might mean that she looked at the big picture as opposed to the isolated incident.
She did, and certainly Mr. Coleman has contended that, you know, he wanted to help her, he wanted to keep her as a client, and that this conversion was a way to make that happen. But I think that Mr. Coleman's subsequent conduct indicates that his motivation was not quite that pure. Had he wanted to just keep her as a client, he could have done the contingency fee contract while still giving her credit for the money paid. Or when she refused to settle so that he would be paid under that contingency fee contract, he could have taken the case to trial. But he didn't. When she refused to settle as he wanted her to, he terminated the representation in all three cases.
Although
the DHP didn't find that there were any unreasonable fees, and you didn't charge him with not keeping records.
Correct. We did not charge him with not keeping records. The reasonableness of the fee, the presiding officer actually did write that the fee was unreasonable and that he found the conversion of the agreement to be wrong. But the other two members of the DHP, therefore the majority, found that he had expended enough work to justify the fee. What's not made clear by the decision is whether they considered the propriety of tacking on fixed hourly fees mm-hmm. that were accrued over a five-year period on top of the contingency fee.
Surely, if they hadn't considered that, that would have made it unreasonable, as you argue. So they must have considered that.
Again, it wasn't articulated in the decision. Perhaps they did. Part of why we bring this, you know, before the court under their de novo review is to present evidence that perhaps a different conclusion could have been drawn.
Mr. Coleman says that you can tell by the fact that he paid the Supreme Court out of his IALTA account and the fact that he presented his agreement, which contained this clause about his taking on the right to settle. He presented it to Judge Guyton, that he did not understand those were inappropriate actions, or he would, because he was very upfront and open about exactly what he was doing and was unaware that they were in violation of the rules. Do you have anything to show to the contrary, or?
Some of the sanctioning guidelines provide for knowing conduct. Some provide for kind of a strict liability in terms of knowing what the rules are. So, no, while I cannot attest to what Mr. Coleman was thinking, what the testimony does prove is that up until today, Mr. Coleman has not acknowledged that any of his conduct was wrong. It was quite the contrary. He insisted that it was fair and that it was within the conduct of the rules.
Let's say, hypothetically, we were to suspend and stay suspension subject to probation, you could fashion the conditions for probation to hopefully set him right in the right course.
Yes, and certainly given his previous conduct, I would hope that that suspension or the terms of probation were for an extended period of time, because it's clear that Mr. Coleman needs that time to improve his practice.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.